Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. As Laura mentioned, I find contact with the social movements has been one of the more interesting things in my life, and frankly, most of the good ideas I've ever come up with have come from people like you, which is why it's great to be here at this conference. Of course, I think the whole kind of question of the municipal level of political activism, what can be done at the municipal level, and what can't be done at the municipal level, these are, I think, important questions. What the relationship is between urban processes and capital accumulation, that's been one of my research interests for many, many years. And also, as Laura mentioned, constant negotiation with Marx's texts on capital and political economy keep me kind of, if you like, in a constant dialogue between both theorizing about how capital is working and at the same time trying to understand what happens when capital hits the ground. And of course, one of the places where capital hits the ground is very much through urban construction, the building of social relations in the city, the organization of space in the city, and the like. When I came here, I thought to myself that for me to talk to you about what's going on the ground is a bit stupid, because you know that better than I do. And in fact, listening to you, I've already been learning some things this morning. But I talk about something that I do know more about, which is what's going on with capital these days. What's the problem with capital? What are the contradictions of capital? Marx, of course, was writing back in the middle of the 19th century, when industrial capitalism was the form of capital that he was most concerned with. But industrial capitalism really only dominated in one very small part of the world, which was Britain, part of Western Europe, and the eastern seaboard of the United States, and that was pretty much it. The rest of the world was, of course, caught up with capital through the activities of merchants and merchant capitalism and so on. But capital-social relations were not global. But one of the theses which comes out of the Communist Manifesto, and which is continued into the Grundrisse and into Capital, was that capital, in order to survive, had to create the world market, and was in the process of creating the world market, and that it was therefore always about, as he said, geographical expansion. But geographical expansion, which was also accompanied by what Marx called the annihilation of space by time, which meant that even though you were geographically expanding, the amount of time it took you to get from one part of the world to another would be constantly reduced. Now, this is a very interesting insight to make in 1848 and 1860. And of course, we've now got to the point where capital pretty much dominates everywhere in the world. There are very few people in the world now who eat their morning breakfast without actually having contact with the circuits of capital accumulation. Whereas when Marx was writing, the majority of the people in the world had their breakfast without any touch or contact whatsoever with capital accumulation. So we now live in a world which is dominated by the circuits of capital and the circulation of capital in ways which were not there in Marx's time, but which Marx said, that's what's going to have to happen to capital over time. And increasingly, I find Marx's kind of commentaries about what's likely to happen, because he theorized what capital is about, and because of his theorizing, could see certain things that were going to happen. And one of the theses that you come across again and again in Capital is that capital is about endless capital accumulation. That is, that it is going to continue over time, and it's going to be continuously expanding. And he also remarked, and this is, I think, critical for our understanding of what is happening today, that if you start to say, what is the form of capital which can expand without limit? It's the money form. That is the form that can expand. It's hard to see production expanding forever. It's hard to see commodities expanding forever. But it's not hard to see the money form expanding forever, provided that the money form is no longer tied down to any kind of material base. And on that point, I would take something that actually the Chinese recognized very, very clearly, which was that there was a key date in the history of capitalism, August the 15th, 1971. And on August 15th, 1971, capital officially went off the gold standard. No longer was it going to be tied down in terms of its monetization to any material commodity like gold. And when it lost its material base, this meant that money capital simply became about numbers. And after that, if there was going to be any disciplining of authority over the amount of money circulating in the world, it was no longer going to be the discipline asserted by the fact that the gold supply is limited, the ability to mine gold is limited. Those limitations were cast aside, and they were given over to the central banks. And the central banks then, after 1971, became crucial arbiters of world money. And as crucial arbiters of world money, they became effectively involved every time there's a crisis of saying, well, we get out of this by actually issuing more money. That is actually what we call quantitative easing. The crisis of 2007-2008 was really resolved by adding zeros to the world's money supply. And since the world's money supply is simply numbers, numbers are infinite. You can always find a number that's larger than the number that's the number. It is what Hegel called a bad infinity. The virtuous infinity is the one that keeps on going forever and ever. It's like the seasons and the rotation of the earth and so on. We know that the sun's going to rise tomorrow morning because it did yesterday and it's going to tomorrow. And it's because there is this motion, which is a cycle. But Marx kind of said, the circulation of capital is not about a cycle. It's about a spiral. And the spiral is endless. And it's constantly opening. And it's moving. And it's a bad infinity, because there's no way in which you can tell where it will go and what it will do. But you have to accommodate to it. And that it's that accommodation which is the sort of thing that is being encountered in contemporary urbanization. How is capital accommodating to the fact that it must grow, and it grows in a spiral form, and it grows in a spiral form for a very simple reason. That is that the predominant motivation for a capitalist economy is profit, which means that there's more at the end of the day than there was at the beginning of the day. And if there's more at the end of the day, the question is, where does the more come from? And then what is done with the more? Now, if capital was sensible, or was like you or me, and you had surplus at the end of the day, you would go out and have a good time with it. But there are structures in place which ensure that capital has to accumulate. That it's not simply about having more at the end of the day, but part of that more has to be reinvested in making more. Therefore, growth is significant. And it's interesting here, because the way we think about the world, the way in which we understand the world, is very much measured by this idea of growth. Growth is necessary. Growth is good. Without growth, we have crisis. All of the financial press, everybody's kind of going on, where's the growth? Oh my goodness, the growth rate's gone down in China. Oh, we're in trouble. oh, the Chinese have reflated, so it's okay. All about growth. Now, as this happens, there are certain structures within capital which Marx is busy unraveling. And he makes the point, which I think is very significant for us, that capital is a system which governs by abstractions. It is not governed by people. It is not given and governed by active conscious agency. We all approach the world with conscious agency, maybe, or maybe not, but the system does not work that way. And in a sense, this is something which Marx took from Adam Smith. When Adam Smith said, well, it doesn't matter about individual motivations because the hidden hand of the market will guide, then what Smith was doing was pointing to mechanisms which would guide the evolution of societies. And what Smith kind of believed was that these mechanisms would guide it in a benevolent way, that it would create the wealth and the need and the power and the goods and everything so that the world could become a better place. What Marx did was to take Adam Smith's proposition and say, yeah, there is a hidden hand. It's not the hidden of the hand of market, it's the hidden hand of labor and the organization of labor. And when you look at the hidden hand that way, what you see is it does not lead necessarily to a promised land. It takes a system which is based upon individual liberty and freedom, as the Lockean theorists put it in the 17th, 18th centuries. It takes that world of individual liberty and freedom and constructs a world which is about wage slavery, debt peonage, inequality. That's what it does. And it uses this notion of individual liberty and freedom as a guiding principle that we should accept as being what we are about, and then forces us to act in such a way that we create unfreedom, illiberal situations. Marx's argument is to take it the other way around and say, what we have to do is to construct a collective situation. A collective situation which will emancipate the individual at the end of the day. That we start with the collectivity. Now, there's a mythology about Marx and Marxism and socialism, which is about the surrender of individual emancipatory individuality to a collective. But that was not what Marx was arguing for. Marx argued that we had to surrender that form of individual liberty which we had constructed in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, we had to surrender that to a collective enterprise in order that the individual could be emancipated. And that individual emancipation therefore rested upon a collective project. That was what Marx was looking for. And I think one of the best ways to express that was a wonderful statement that one of my favorite authors, Henri Lefebvre, made when he was asked why, since he was constantly interacting with the anarchists, why he was not an anarchist. Why was he a Marxist? And his answer was, I'm a Marxist, so one day we can all live like anarchists. And it's a fantastic way to summarize what Marx was about. That I'm a Marxist because this is the only way in which we can create a world in which individuals are truly liberated. We pretend that we have a world of individualism and liberty and freedom and private property and all the rest of it. We pretend that. But in our daily lives, do we have it? The answer is no. And everybody these days knows that. Everybody knows that. And what we're seeing all around the world are eruptions like Chile, Beirut, even in Baghdad, even in Tehran. Eruptions in which people are saying, this economic model which we have constructed is not working for us. It may be working for the top 1% or the top 10% or whatever, but it's not working for us, and we want a different economic model. That is what is being said again and again and again. And if you look over the last, 30, 40 years, it has been said, Seattle and the anti-globalization movement, and then Gezi Park in Turkey, what happened in Brazil in 2013, all of that. Again and again and again, we're seeing these eruptions because the economic work model is not working for the mass of the people. And I think it's fantastic that Pinheiro gave an interview to the Financial Times 10 days before Santiago blew up, in which he said, Chile is an oasis. It's an oasis. It's got the highest income per capita, all of the economic aggregates, everything is macroeconomically in order. It is a guide, a lodestone, if you like, for the whole of the rest of Latin America in terms of how to organize an economy. And he was delighted. And then 10 days later, poof, it all blew up. And he then didn't know how to handle it. He didn't understand what it was that people are saying. But again and again and again, we're seeing movements which simply attest to the fact that the dominant economic model is not working. And it's not working for people. And people understand it is not working, and they want something different. Doesn't mean they want socialism, doesn't mean they want Marxism, doesn't want they mean anything. It could mean anything. But something different has to be found. And then the question arises, well, why is the economic model not working? What is it about capital in this time which makes it absolutely sort of impossible for it to work without doing the kind of violence it's doing to populations all around the world? Now here, Marx has a very interesting thing that he loves to quote, both in the Grundrisse and in Volume 3 of Capital. And it's from somebody writing at the end of the 18th century, a certain Dr. Price, who in 1772 wrote a couple of tracts. And the main thing about Dr. Price's tracts was that he had discovered that there was something called compound interest. And the compound interest was a tremendously powerful force. And so he wrote a little thing. He said, one penny invested on the day of Jesus Christ's birth at 5% would, by the time I'm living, have produced a value in the world that would need 150 solid gold earths to accommodate it. That is just one penny invested. He said, that contrasts with simple interest, not compounding. He said, one penny invested would, by my time, be worth £4.07 and 3p, or something like that. Forgot the exact numbers. But the difference between simple interest and compound interest is huge. But he then went on to remark that you, for the first, 50 years or so, you don't notice it. But you then reach a point where it starts to get inflection and it starts to accelerate. And the exponential growth curve becomes the problem. Now, when I was 15 years old, and I'm betraying something here about my age, it was 1950. There are lots of people recently who've been trying to get a measure of what the total global economy has been. Now, they all come up with different strategies and different figures, but they all tell roughly the same story, but with different kind of nuances of the numbers. I'll use the numbers given by this economist, Brad DeLong. And he says, in 1950, the total output of goods and services in the global economy was something about $4 trillion in 1990 dollars. $4 trillion. By the time you get to the year 2000, it's $40 trillion. Okay. By the time we get to now, it's closer to $80 trillion. It turns out when you look at it, it doubles every 25 years. So, yeah. In 2000, it's $40 trillion. Now it's getting closer to $80 trillion. That means down the line it's going to be 160 trillion by 2050. You see where we're going. This is a huge increase in the total amount of capital that there is in the world. And that huge increase, I would argue, began to have real serious difficulties of finding places to go, building markets, creating new possibilities from 1970s onwards. And right now, it's faced with very critical problems. Where is the surplus capital going to go? And the surplus capital is being fed by quantitative easing, adding millions to the global money supply. And there is always the kind of interesting kind of question of who benefits from the quantitative easing. Now here, I discovered something last January. There was a very interesting article came out about a report by the Bank of England on the benefits of quantitative easing. Who benefited most from quantitative easing? My intuition, and I guess everybody else's, was, well, basically quantitative easing flows into the stock market, produces, you know, inflates the stock market, and therefore the ultra-rich benefit from quantitative easing. But the headline in the Financial Times about the Bank of England report was, that's not true. The poorest 10% benefited most from quantitative easing. And I was kind of taken aback, and I was a bit shocked. Fortunately, right at the end, they said, what does this actually mean to say that the poorest 10% benefited far more than the top 10%? It was this, that the poorest 10% over a six-year period received a benefit of £3,000, which is about £10 a week. The top 10% benefited by £325,000 over that period, which is about £100 a week. And you kind of go, well, wait a minute. What's going on here? Of course, what was really being measured by this was the fact that the lowest 10% had such lousy incomes that you gave them just a little bit, and it was a more proportionately, the rate was much greater for them than it was for the top 10%. On the other hand, the top 10% had a huge increase in the mass, whereas the bottom 10% had very little increase in the mass. And suddenly I thought to myself, well, there's something wrong about talking about rates rather than masses. Now, I offer you two choices. Would you rather have a 10% rate of increase on $100 or a 3% rate of increase on $3 million? Which would you prefer? Would you take the higher rate? No, you wouldn't give a shit about the higher rate. It's the mass. And actually, this carries over internationally in very interesting ways. China's had a huge rate of growth in the 1990s. Its rate of growth is much less now. It's only about 6%. And earlier this year, people were getting very worried about the Chinese growth rate going down. The Chinese didn't seem to be too concerned about it, because when they were growing at 12% back in 2000, they only got half of the new output that they got in 2018 by growing at half that rate, 6%, because by then their economy was so much larger. So there's an interesting question about whether we think about rates or whether we would think about masses. And here I have a huge fight, at least I think I do, with a lot of my Marxist economist colleagues who are always writing about the falling rate of profit. And to them, this is the explanation of everything. But actually, if you just read Marx's thing very carefully, we don't even have to read it carefully, just read it casually. And what you find is about five or six pages into Marx's exposition about the falling rate of profit, he says, well, actually, we have to also think about the rising mass. And what I'm really talking about is a theory of falling rate and rising mass. And the rising mass becomes very significant in many areas, because towards the end of his chapter on the falling rate of profit, he says, how is that mass going to be absorbed? There's a realization problem. Because if there is a rising mass, then there's a mass of commodities. How are those new commodities going to be absorbed? And what kinds of things are going to have to happen in the economy to absorb them? We're going to have to change wants, needs, and desires in society. We're going to have to change all kinds of things. And when you start to look at the mass, you suddenly realize, yes, there is a point where the mass becomes the real problem. There was a time when the plastics industry was producing, and the mass of plastic waste was not a problem. Now, it's a clear problem. The mass has got to a point where it goes toxic. Here's another one. Look at climate change. NOAA produced a wonderful graph of carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere over the last 800,000 years. How they got it, I don't know, but anyway, at no point in the last 800,000 years did the carbon concentrations rise above 300 parts per million. They didn't do it until 1960, when it passed through the 300, and it's now around 417. In other words, there is no point in the last 800,000 years where the carbon concentrations were anywhere near close to what they are now, which says that the problem right now with global warming is that the mass of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere already up there is so huge that even if we reduce the rate to zero from now on, you're still going to melt the Arctic ice and you probably get rid of most of the Greenland glaciers and even worse, disappear the Himalayan snowpack, which would turn the Indus and the Ganges into seasonal rivers. And therefore, we have to look at the mass. And we've got to do something about the mass. In other words, what we should be doing right now is taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere to get us back down to 300. Not worry about, are we going to be at zero, three, you know, by 2050 or something like that. So the question of the rate and the mass becomes very significant. And the mass problem poses all sorts of interesting questions. Let me just take up one line that comes out of it. For instance, if you're going to realize all of that value which is being produced through consumption, then you need a mode of consumption which is going to be able to absorb the increase. And then you think, well, okay, we'll try and give everybody refrigerators, and let me take that as an example. A refrigerator is a consumer good, a consumer durable, and more houses have refrigerators in them, and so there's a market for refrigerators, and the market is expanding as households expand and so on. So there is a market for refrigerators. But it doesn't expand very rapidly. It's not on that exponential curve. It's just sort of more arithmetic. So if capital made things like refrigerators, which lasted, 20 years, 15, 20 years or whatever, and that's what it did, then that won't work in terms of the expansion of consumption. I jokingly will often say, look, I am still using my grandmother's knives and forks. If capital made things that lasted, it would have died a long time ago because it couldn't find an exponential outlet for its growth. So it has to start making things that disappear or things that fall apart or things that become obsolete. I mean, look at cell phones. I mean, you're making things obsolescent, you know, sort of every 2 years, every 4 years. I mean, in other words, you have to go to a society which is about instant obsolescence, but instant obsolescence of everything. I mean, this carries over to instant obsolescence of labor processes, instant obsolescence. So we're in a society which is doing things like that. Now, it then heads into what is the shortest turnover time you could imagine in the sphere of consumption. And here, there was a very incredibly prescient thing. When Guy Debord wrote his book about the society of the spectacle in, 1967 or something like that, he was talking about something which I think is really critical. Because spectacle is something that is instantaneously experienced and instantaneously disappears. So we go for more and more spectacle. And you start to produce an economy which is built around that. Now, let me give you just two examples of a specific kind of economy. One would be called, let's take the Netflix economy. A lot of value is created by, you know, making a Netflix special. A lot of goes into it. But look how it's marketed. It's marketed, has a fantastic marketing capacity. That there is no exclusionary consumption of it. 1 million people can watch, you know, the last episode of the Game of Thrones or whatever. And it's over in an hour. It's gone. That's an instantaneous consumption. Furthermore, you can preserve it, and there's a sort of tail end of consumerism, like anybody can click into the Netflix anytime. You know, you have to monetize this somehow or other, so how do you do it? Well, you subscribe to Netflix, and so it's done by subscription, or it's done as Amazon does it by, you know, you pay for what you see. But this is a mode of consumption, which is perfect, if you like, because it is the least... It's the minimum temporality. Let me give you another one, which is much more relevant to what you guys are interested in, which is tourism. Tourism is, of course, about selling an experience. And you're selling the experience. And once the experience is over, you go back and you have a few photos of it and all that. So tourism is a great... And guess what? Capital has done over the last 30, 40 years. What's happened to the tourist industry? Tourism has become huge, part, because it's a mode of consumption which is consistent with it can expand very, very fast. Now, I checked out the tourist board the other day, World Tourist Board, and they said that in 2006 or 2007 or something like that, the total number of visits around the world was something like 800 million. Now, and we've been in difficult times, right, it's up to 1.4 billion. It has increased by 600 million over the last 10 years or so. 600 million more tourists milling around. Now, the result is that many places in the world which were doing very well on the tourist industry are beginning to find this is a sickening problem, because you need to build the infrastructures, you need all the transport and communications, you need all that kind of stuff, and you've got all of these cheap air flights, so tourism and everything, the whole kind of thing is a huge kind of consumer of greenhouse gas emissions and so on. And then you've got to accommodate all these, and so what happens? Well, somebody comes up with the idea of Airbnb, and it's a sharing economy, it gets capitalized, and suddenly, you know, Barcelona's overrun with Airbnb, and you know, all the major centers in the world are completely caught up. And the only thing worse than not having tourism is having tourism. And there gets to be a point where actually some cities, which once upon a time I liked to visit and thought were very beautiful places, I was in Florence last year. It was horrible. I just couldn't wait to get out. And so here you go, the mass of tourists start to actually destroy. And there's, of course, ecotourism, which is destroying the environment now at a huge rate. Now, but all of this comes back to the fact that capital is about a spiral form. You know, we haven't got yet to the kind of 150 gold earths. But nevertheless, we're getting to the point where we're wrecking the planet and wrecking ourselves by the fact that we are caught up in compound growth. All of the data which have been assembled says that capital has been growing at a compound rate, and here the numbers will vary, somewhere between 2 and 4% per annum. And when you go to the financial press, oh yeah, things are okay if they're, you know, 2.4%, that's okay. Japan has been at zero, that's very bad. But what are we going to do when this $80 trillion economy, which we're now in, is going to be the $160 trillion? And how are we going to absorb the extra $80 trillion over the next few years? Now, this says to me there are various reasons why you would want to be anti-capitalist. When I'm reading Marx, it's very clear that the reason for being anti-capitalist was because precisely what it did to the working class and the workers and all the rest of it, and the conditions of labor in the Manchester factories and of the Industrial Reserve Army and all of that was, you know, intolerable, inhumane. So all kinds of good reasons why you would want to be anti-capitalist coming out of that. But what was not in Marx, which I think is there today, is that one of the good reasons to be anti-capital today is that we cannot continue with compound rates of growth over the next 100 years. That there is no way, environmentally, ecologically, in terms of the turnover time of capital and the turnover time of industrial structures, what we're finding is that the temporality has shifted. And it's not as if this is inconsistent with Marx's analysis. Marx was working in a particular time of temporality, but he saw that one of the ways in which capital had to work was through speed up, acceleration. And I've been through this life as acceleration. I mean, when I came into academia, which was, as you tell, a very long time ago, the general ambition was, if you published more than 2 books in a lifetime, it was because you were not serious. Now, if you don't publish a book every 2 years, people think you died. The whole culture of time and temporality shifts. Now, one of the things that Marx talks about is to say, what is the marker of truly emancipatory individual? It's disposable free time. And what should be created is a society where we have the maximum amount of disposable free time. And I've lived in a world where actually we have less and less disposable free time. And one of the reasons politics is so difficult is people are so damn busy all of the time, they don't have time to think. They don't have time to reflect. They don't have time to politically organize. And so actually capital absorbs time and destroys time and is doing that because of the acceleration. And it does it with space too. When Marx said, capital is about the annihilation of space through time, he said, capital would be about a thing where actually the cost of the cost of circulation time is zero. Now, you can accelerate stuff around the world, and of course, finance can whiz around the world. I mean, if you sort of followed an idealized dollar bill around the world, and how fast it was moving now compared to in the past. So this acceleration and the compression is creating this kind of world in which it hits the ground, of course, very hard in terms of what urbanization is about. Because urbanization is increasingly about creating cities for people to invest in, not creating decent environments to live in. It's not about, for capital, it's not about it. And people are fed up with it. And it's no accident that the trigger for many of the revolts in recent times has been urban transportation problems. I mean, I'm amazed that we haven't had a complete riot in New York City, because the subway system in New York City is catastrophic. So these are the kind of macro things which impinge upon us in our daily lives and make for certain things happening. And what we're trying to do is to create an alternative universe. But my argument would be, yes, it's incredibly important to try to do that wherever you are and whatever you're doing. It's incredibly important, and actually, politically and personally, very much more satisfying to work on that. But that it has, at the same time, to start to address the incredible power of the mass, which is now in the hands of very few people. I mean, the reason that, say, the Koch brothers in the United States are so powerful politically is not because of the rate of growth. It's because of the mass that they control and the ability to use that mass politically, economically, and socially to total domination. And they are the ones who are benefiting from this system, and they are also benefiting economically from the cultivation of a certain kind of economic theory which emphasizes things about rates. So you can point to the rates and say, well, yeah, they're good. But when you look at the masses, they're not. And that therefore we should always pay attention to both where the economic theory is coming from, in whose interest it is being constructed, and why it is being constructed in the particular way it is. And then also recognize that compound growth forever is not a feasible proposition, that something different is going to happen and will happen, because the system has this internal contradiction, which I think can be best summarized by the following idea. The capital these days has become far too big to fail, but it's become far too monstrous to survive. Thank you.
To give a response.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.